Wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honour and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all other, keep thee only unto her so long as you both shall live? And the man shall answer, I will. Promises, you see, are important, especially in relationships. We human beings are very complex creatures. Even in our most rational moments, our actions are subject to great uncertainty. And when our hearts rule our heads, as they do most of the time, we can be quite infuriatingly capricious. That's why psychologists have to resort to statistics so much, to render human behavior amenable to scientific analysis. Normality has to be an average, and with a very large standard deviation to it at that. An abnormality often seems quite arbitrary, fixed more by what society will tolerate than by any clear limitation on the inherent eccentricity of man. The human individual is simply unpredictable. A machine will always respond as you want it to. And if it doesn't, there'll always be a good reason. But no matter how well you know a person, they never lose their capacity to quite inexplicably surprise you, do they? A prophet in the Old Testament once compared the human race to a flock of sheep in that respect. He said, we turn everyone to our own way. Very appropriate analogy. Acquaintance of mine, as a zoologist, told me about a university research project on normal walk in animals. This particular scientist had a course marked out across his laboratory with various kinds of instrumentation fitted to it to try to measure how the way animals walked differ from one species to another. He got excellent results with all manners of beasts, all that is except the sheep. No two sheep ever walked that course the same way. Indeed, no single sheep ever walked that course the same way twice. Sheep behavior simply would not provide reproducible results. The sheep apparently is not only perverse, it's individualistically perverse. And according to the prophet Isaiah, he shares that characteristic with man. Human behavior is always idiosyncratic. It's not enough that we go the wrong way, it has to be our own way. A way different from anybody else's. We are very original sinners. And that, of course, makes life difficult. This indeterminacy in man's behavior doesn't just frustrate the psychologist, it threatens to undermine organized society as a whole. Because, you see, people whose behavior can't be predicted are people who can't be relied upon, can't be trusted. And without trust, relationships are impossible. Go back to what we started with, marriage, for instance. Now, a relationship that can be terminated by the whim of either party can never be a deep and satisfying union. Because neither party can really afford to take the emotional risk of total self-giving to the other, innit? What happens if he or she decides to desert me suddenly? I should be unendurably shattered, we say. Now, a marriage with no promises has got to be a marriage with reservations. It can't be anything else. A potential victim to suspicion and doubt all the time. But we dare not commit all our hopes to a person we can't trust. And you can't trust a person whose future responses can't be reliably predicted. And that's why I say the promise is important. A promise, you see, is a voluntary decision to behave predictably. That's what a promise is. Without destroying the freedom of our responses, it makes those responses reliable. I will love you, I will comfort you, I will keep you, I will be faithful to you. The husband vows it to his wife, you see. So that this relationship is taken out of the orbit of fickle passion and placed instead on a basis of truthfulness. The vital issue is no longer, am I clever enough to predict his or her future behavior? The issue is now, can I rely on his word? The promise, by its pledge of constancy, makes a relationship of trust possible, where previously it would have been foolhardy and presumptuous. Now, this morning, I'm here to tell you something most remarkable. God makes promises too. And those promises are vitally important in our relationship with him. For the same reason, they're vitally important in a relationship like marriage. For you see, God's behavior is not easily predicted either. He's not like us, capricious or irrational, but his personality is immensely complex. The prophet says, "How unsearchable are his judgments, his paths beyond tracing. Who can fathom the mind of the Lord?" What's more, God retains for himself, according to the Bible, a prerogative of sovereign freedom. And that means while his actions are always in character, they're never mechanical or automatic. They're always personal choices. "Our God is in the heavens," says the psalmist. "He does whatever he pleases." Now, if you put the inscrutability of God's intelligence and the autonomy of his will, you put those two things together, and man is confronted by a situation in which, to put it frankly, he can never be quite sure what God is going to do next. Noah must have felt a bit nervous about that during the flood. After all, God had put up with man's evil for centuries. And then suddenly, without warning, his patience is exhausted and he descends on the earth in devastating judgment. True, he gave Noah a way of escape. But quite frankly, his extraordinary exhibition of mercy towards Noah and his family came just as much out of the blue as did the rain that drowned the rest of mankind. Who was to say that next time it wouldn't be Noah and his sons who would be the victims of divine displeasure? Surely the only attitude it's safe to adopt towards a God whose anger can flare so unexpectedly is one of terror, of deep misgiving. Sudden floods of judgment aren't really conducive to peace of mind, are they? And yet the strange thing is, the Bible insists that we must trust God. It even goes so far as to tell us that Noah himself was a model of faith. Now, how can you possibly trust a God who is so unpredictable? I'll tell you, you can trust him for the same reason you ought to be able to trust your husband or your wife. Not because you can necessarily anticipate their every move, but because you can rely on their word. See what God says in chapter 9, verse 8. God said to Noah, "I now establish my covenant with you." This, I say, is the most remarkable and distinctive characteristic of the God of the Bible. He is a God who makes promises. He stands before men like a husband before his bride, and he says, "I will." And on the basis of that divine promise, a new relationship between man and God is made possible. A relationship based not on fear, but on trust. The Bible calls it a covenant. And this morning we're going to notice three things about that covenant relationship which God initiated with Noah, which are in fact paralleled by all God's covenant dealings with man. You'll find them on the sheet: a new security, a new commandment, and a new significance. Three aspects of this covenant relationship God was starting with Noah. Let's look at a new security, first of all. Look back at verses 15 and 16 of the previous chapter, chapter 8 first. God said to Noah, "Come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives." You see, for over a year, Noah had been cooped up in this floating zoo with his in-laws. It can't have been a very comfortable existence. For the first 40 days, he'd been buffeted and bounced around by the elements in a way which must have been quite terrifying for a man not used to the sea. Since the rain had stopped, things had been quieter, rather more tedious. But the immediate terror of the waves must have given way to a more grim anxiety. Ever since the ark had grounded and the mountains appeared, it became clear that the floods were going down. Sooner or later, they would be able to uncover the ark and step out on dry land again. Noah had plenty of that time to think in those latter weeks, staring out across the calm sea from that little window so thoughtfully provided in the plans. What sort of world would it be, this new world he would step out in? More important, what sort of mood would this unpredictable God be in when he stepped out on that new world? He knew enough about his sons to realize that the seeds of evil which God had so ferociously judged in the world were not absent from his family. I've no doubt the domestic situation with the ark gave ample evidence of that during those 12 months in its tiny confinement. His family had survived this storm. What about the next one? As he stepped out onto that deserted hillside, I have no doubt at all that anxieties like that were tormenting his mind. And that's why I'm sure his first thought was to offer sacrifice. He wanted to be sure God's anger had been satisfied, that the world was now acceptable to him once again. And he discovered that it was, in a way which went far beyond his expectation, perhaps. Look what he says in verse 21. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again. Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. Never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done." Notice this promise that God makes. It is, first of all, unchanging. Never again, he says. It's important not to overstate the terms. God isn't saying there'll be no more disasters. What he's promising is that any disasters that occur would be local ones. They would not destroy all flesh. But even with that limitation, these are wonderful promises. God, you see, is voluntarily restricting himself for man's sake to a pattern of reliable blessing. We rely upon these promises every day of our lives in the predictability, the uniformity of nature. An unchanging promise. A unilateral promise, too. I want you to notice that. God said it in his heart. There were no negotiations. This promise derived from the depths of the divine personality. Noah's sacrifice didn't persuade God to make this promise. My God had already indicated his intention before the flood to make his covenant with Noah. You'll find the first reference to it in chapter 6, verse 18. Now, the fact that God accepted Noah's sacrifice was simply evidence that the covenant was on. God wouldn't have responded to his sacrifice with pleasure had not his heart already been set on blessing. One of the things that comes out very clearly, I think, from these chapters is that this covenant isn't a bargain. It's a sovereign declaration. God says, "I establish my covenant with you." The picture probably is that of a monarch in the ancient world imposing a treaty on a conquered people, guaranteeing to defend them. So God unilaterally here, you see, claims the world as his protectorate. But it's quite unilateral. And the third thing about it, it's unconditional. Even though every inclination of man's heart is evil, he says. God is under no illusions about Noah's family. He knew it would take more than genetic engineering to purge the remnants of Adam's fall out of the human race. But the intractability of evil wasn't going to prejudice the covenant. It was a promise made not because of man's moral achievement, but in spite of his moral failure. You know, at the beginning of chapter 9 here, if you look, we see Noah being blessed in a way very similar to the way in which Adam was blessed at the very beginning of the book of Genesis. Just like Adam, we find there he's mandated to fill the earth and subdue it. Just as with Adam, he's given supremacy over all the animals. But you see, there's a difference now, a very important difference. Adam's blessing all depended on obedience. Should he rebel against God, then all would be forfeited in death. His enjoyment of the paradise of Eden was conditional. But not so with Noah. All these blessings now stand not on a covenant of human works, but on a covenant of God's grace. No matter how wicked the world would become, God said, the sun would still get up every morning. God would tell it to. The seasons would still rotate. It was a promise, unchanging, unilateral, unconditional. This, I say, is immense security. With these powerful assurances, God silenced Noah's anxieties. Without in any way compromising the fierceness of his anger against human wickedness, he was making it possible for sinful man to enjoy a relationship of trust with him. Noah and his sons would have peace of heart. They would sleep at night. In spite of the terrifying trauma of the flood that they just endured, God had gone on oath to make them secure. That's a very wonderful thing. And that's a fruit of all God's covenant dealings with man. When you and I enter a covenant with God, we experience that kind of security, that kind of peace. We do not fear anymore. We can trust. That's the first thing, then, a new security. The second thing I want you to notice about it is the new commandment. Look at chapter 9, verses 4 to 6. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each man too I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man. Now, we've already seen that the terms of this promise were unconditional. So we ought not to think that a failure to keep these requirements that are mentioned here could endanger the security of which we've been speaking. Not so. God had said never again, and he meant it. But that doesn't mean that man, you see, by God making this promise, was released from all moral responsibility. Certainly not. With the covenant promise comes covenant obligation. After all, think of it this way. Just because you've married someone doesn't mean that you can take them for granted. Many divorcees discover it's possible to be just as miserable within the security of a marital relationship as they would have been if they'd never married at all. The initial promise makes a good relationship possible, but if it's going to become a reality, it requires a determined and continual effort to live in harmony with the other party. So too with man's relationship to God. The promise is the foundation for it, but there's plenty of room for man to experience the displeasure of God even within this unchanging covenant. The human accountability is built into the terms of the contract. I will surely demand an accounting, says God. Once again, I want you to notice three aspects of this new commandment. It teaches us about three quite distinct things, I think. First of all, it teaches us about the sanctity of human life. For each man, it says, I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow. Obviously, the flood had not eliminated the seed of Adam. But you know, it had completely removed the whole tribe of Cain. I think that's significant. I think there's a very clear implication in these verses that God was determined to prevent the escalation of that murderous violence which Cain had introduced and which had been so characteristic of pre-diluvian society. If you've been coming along in previous weeks, you'll remember we've mentioned this on a number of occasions. And one of the things God is doing in order to establish that is to lay down in man's racial memory the principle of the sacredness of human life. You may take animal life, he says. It's part of your dominion over creation. But human life belongs to me. Human life has special dignity. Why? Because it bears my image. Human life is unique, and therefore those who take it must give account to me for what they have done. Cain, of course, tried to escape that responsibility, didn't he? Am I my brother's keeper, he said. Well, God is making quite clear to Noah and his descendants that they are, because in every human face lies reflected the countenance of God. I dare not treat the life of my neighbor with contempt. For in disdaining him, I insult my Creator. goes without saying that this is enormously important in our contemporary world. We face, you know, a world in which there is observable a very disturbing slide towards the careless taking of life. I guess we've all been made aware of the recent huge publicity surrounding the abortion legislation that's before Parliament at the moment. Statistics in this matter aren't very easy to come by, but you know, it's estimated that in the Western world, well over 1 million unborn babies are killed every year. In the USA alone, there are probably 6 million fewer children under the age of 8 as a result of liberal abortion legislation. Now, what excuses do we plead for that kind of wanton destruction of life? Oh, we say, these are unwanted babies. These would have been abnormal babies. These babies would have endangered the mother's psychological health. But who, pray, are these officious and arrogant technocrats who presume to pass such judgments on the utility of a human life? Man may only dispose of that which belongs to him. And this text tells us that the life of a child does not belong to the doctors, doesn't even belong to the mother. It belongs to God. The psalmist says, "You created me in my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained to me were written down in your book." Right there, in utero. There's no way then we can dispose of the life of an unborn child without playing God. I don't say abortion is never permissible. In our fallen world, sometimes we have only choices that are lessers of evil choices. We can't always make the good choice we would like to. But it is a most momentous and awesome moral responsibility. We're going to put the image of God in a hospital incinerator. We'd better have a good explanation ready, don't you think? And be sure of this, once society's view of the sanctity of life has been undermined, the destruction of human beings won't stop there at abortion. It's but a short step from killing an unwanted baby in the womb to killing an unwanted baby outside the womb. It's but a short step from killing an unwanted baby to killing an unwanted adult. Abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, these are all parts of the same moral issue. How many millions was it who died in Nazi extermination camps? How many millions perished in Leninist purges? How many bodies lie still uncounted in Pol Pot's Cambodia? They had their excuses too, you know. They called them genetically inferior or ideologically unsound. They labelled them Jew or bourgeois, but basically those millions died for the same reason those millions of unborn babies die. Because those who held the reins of power over them decreed they were unwanted, dangerous, deformed. Once the sanctity of human life is no longer respected, there is no limit to the cold-blooded brutality to which man can sink. Now, MP Corrie is quite right to be concerned about the scale of abortions in our day. It is the thin end of a wedge, the logic of which leads all the way to the gas chambers of Auschwitz. We ought to be aware of that. The sanctity of human life, then. That's the first thing this commandment given to Noah all those centuries ago implies for us. The second thing, I think, which is contained within it is the responsibility for execution of justice. At verse 6, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed." Now, there are those who wish to read this simply as a warning, rather like our Lord's words, "Those who live by the sword must expect to die by the sword." But I'm fairly sure there's more to it than that. You see, when Cain killed his brother, he was afraid that someone at some time would take vengeance on him. And at that time, God said no. No one was allowed to take Cain's life to avenge Abel's murder. If they did, they would render themselves liable to sevenfold vengeance. If that mercy on God's part was aimed at moving Cain and his descendants to repent their bloody crimes, then he must have been sorely disappointed. For as we saw last week, violence simply escalated. The rule of non-retaliation became a mockery. Perhaps some of you can remember Lamech's depraved boast. I've killed a man now. If Cain's executioner should be avenged seven times, mine should be 77 times. Now what we see here, you see, in chapter 9, is a reversal of God's earlier legislative decree of non-retaliation. He is now ordering civil justice in society. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. He's empowering man to wield the sword of divine retribution against the murderer. He's establishing, if you like, the basis of capital punishment. Not that this verse necessarily commands capital punishment for murder, I think, but it certainly permits it. And this permission was not given before. There was no avenue previously through which the wrath of God could be expressed against the criminal. And the result was that before the flood, that wrath accumulated till eventually it burst the dike of God's patience and flooded the world with judgment. But now, human civil authority would legitimately take revenge on the wrongdoer. It would, as Paul would later say, bear the sword of God's wrath on his behalf. The principle of sanctity of life would still apply. It would be a solemn and burdensome responsibility to wield that sword. For God still says, I will demand an accounting. There's no approbation here for the lynching mob or for the murderous tyrant. He will demand an accounting of the murderer. He will demand it also of the executioner. But that God is here ordering civil justice, I have no doubt. And certainly later developments in Genesis seem to confirm that. But the third, perhaps in some ways most interesting aspect of these puzzling verses is what they teach man about the sacredness of blood. You see, in verse 4, you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. It's been suggested that man had not previously been a meat eater before the flood, and that would be surprising if so, because we read of several Adam's descendants that kept livestock, and one could hardly imagine they did that without a view to eating them. I think it's more likely that man began to eat meat immediately after the expulsion from Eden, perhaps because of the decreased fertility of the soil, but that God was now regularizing this, permitting it. What are we to make, though, of this strange reference to meat with blood in it? Some suggest it's an early anticipation of what would later be formulated in the Jewish food regulations. But if that were so, then surely one ought to expect some kind of prohibition, some kind of taboo regarding eating non-kosher meat, observable in human society generally, not just Jewish society. And no such observation is possible. Jehovah's Witnesses, of course, interpret it to mean that we must refuse blood transfusions, which is certainly stripping the verse from his historical context in a most wild way. My own view is this, that what God is doing here is giving men permission to be a hunter, but not a carnivore. See, literally what the text says is, you must not eat meat with the life, that is the blood in it. In other words, man may not consume living flesh like a wild animal. Most people, I think, are squeamish about blood from an open womb, and I take that to be a racial memory of this ancient taboo, whether we're right in that or not. The most important thing about this text, as far as we're concerned, is not the precise nature of the food regulation it teaches, but the theological connection that it establishes between life and blood. God is teaching people by this command here that blood is precious. You must treat it very carefully, he says, because it represents the life. And as we've just said, life belongs to God, not to man. Innocent blood, shed unwillingly, cries to God like the blood of Abel did, for vengeance. But later God would use this connection between blood and life to teach men something else. That innocent blood shed voluntarily can cry to God like the blood of Christ for mercy. Here in this link between life and blood is a theme that doesn't reach its zenith till it comes to this very table that's before us this morning. Here is blood that we not only may eat, but which Christian believers are commanded to eat. For Jesus says, if you do not drink my blood, you have no life in you. A new commandment then. With the covenant security come covenant obligations. And we shall find that too. If we come into covenant with God and find new security by trusting his promises, we must not think that we can then become complacent and live as we please. We shall find that God lays upon us obligations, responsibilities, commandments, as our response to his promise. The third thing I want you to notice about this covenant, this promise that God made to Noah, a new significance. Look down at verses 12 to 13 of chapter 9. God said, this is the sign of the covenant I'm making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds. Now, have you ever wondered why at a wedding the groom gives the bride a ring? It's getting expensive with the price of gold going the way it is. Of course, it's a very ancient tradition, and you find parallels to it in every culture in the world. It's a memento, of course, isn't it? A souvenir, if you like. Days may come when the marriage will go through difficult tensions, rocky passages. But she will look down on her hand and see the ring on her finger and remember the promises. That's the idea of it. The ring is a sign of the marriage, a token. Well, now this verse tells us that God doesn't wear a ring on his finger. He spreads his ring across the sky. When I see the rainbow, he says, I will remember my covenant. It's a perfect sign when you think about it. For a start, you only get a rainbow when the sun shines through the rain. It could scarcely be a physical phenomenon more suited to testify to God's determination that the rain would stop. Another thing about it is that in the Hebrew, just as in the English, the word for rainbow is the same as the word for an archer's bow. So if you like, the symbolism is there of God laying aside his hostility towards man in this sign. But more than that, it's a peculiarly appropriate sign because of this. The rainbow is all-inclusive. It embraces the whole world. You see, all the covenants God works in the Bible have much in common, but they also possess certain distinguishing features, and the distinctive thing about this covenant with Noah, which we haven't yet noted, but which we must, is that it is universal. These promises God makes do not just benefit Noah, not even his immediate family, if you look closely. The promises apply, we read, to all his descendants, to all living creatures, even to the very earth itself. Do you notice in verse 13, it speaks of a covenant between God and the earth. We said there was no moral condition laid upon this covenant. It goes beyond that. The world would benefit from this promise, irrespective of whether it even knew about the existence of the promise or not. Man in his ignorance would benefit from it. Animals in their irrationality would benefit from it. Even the good earth in its unconsciousness would benefit from it. That's why theologians sometimes call this covenant the covenant of common grace. It's a blessing which God gives to all. Like the rainbow, the whole world is embraced by the divine love this promise guarantees. Maybe you're not a Christian this morning. Maybe you're not even a believer in God. Perhaps you never even give religion a second thought. But you're a beneficiary from this promise. The rainbow covers you, and God remembers. So in spite of all your failures and your rejection of God, no storm of judgment bursts on your head, does it? You're protected. Protected by this universal promise that God has made with all creation. But I'm bound to say this to you. This is not the only covenant God has made with man. There's another one. Jesus called it the new covenant. It too promises security. Eternal life is guaranteed to those who are enfolded in this new covenant. It too contains a new commandment. Love one another, says Jesus. And it too has a visible sign, but not a rainbow this time. For you see, unlike Noah's covenant, this new covenant is not universal. Jesus stood at this table and he said, "This is the new covenant in my blood. My blood shed for many." Not all, for many. The promise of forgiveness of sins and eternal life that this covenant table speaks about are not just recognized by faith, they are appropriated by faith. You do not become a participant in this covenant automatically. For in this new covenant which God establishes with man, not only does God stand and say, "I will" to man must stand and respond, "I will" to God. And for that reason, you see, the sign of this new covenant cannot be the all-embracing rainbow. No, the sign of the new covenant is baptism. So the New Testament tells us, a sign that requires a response of the individual, a sign that excludes all except believers, a sign which not only reminds God of his promise to the Christian, but reminds the Christian of his promise to God. And the question I have for you this morning, finally, is this. We've learned about the covenant with Noah. You're a beneficiary from that. Ought you not to think about being a beneficiary under the terms of God's new covenant? Aren't I right when I say that man is afraid for the future today? We have built great military engines of self-destruction. We have played with economic crises, with population explosions, with the prospect of ecological disasters on a global scale. I don't think ever since the days of Noah has man been so conscious that he lives on the very brink of catastrophe. Insecurity is the hallmark of the latter half of this century we live in. Perhaps Jesus' prophetic words are coming true. He said nations would be in anguish and perplexity, that men would be faint from terror, apprehensive of what was coming on the world. Where are you and I going to find peace of mind in such a day? We shall find it only in the promises of God. The writer to the Hebrews in the New Testament talks about God's promises as an anchor for our souls. They are that. They give us security in a world as precarious as ours. The religious choice that confronts us men is stark and uncomplicated. It's faith or despair. Trust or terror. There was a day when evangelists had to hang their congregations over the pit of hell to wake them up to the fearfulness of living without God. You don't have to do that anymore. The newspapers do it for you. This covenant with Noah provides us with some comfort this morning, some security. And yet you know it has a grave weakness. The time scale of this covenant with Noah, though huge, is not unlimited. Do you see what he says in 8 verse 22? As long as the earth endures, he says. But the Bible makes it clear the earth will not endure forever. The day will come, says the apostle, when the present heavens and earth will disappear, when God will present to man, rather as he did to Noah, a new earth purged clean of sin, this time not just partially, but totally, not just temporarily, but eternally, a new earth where righteousness is at home, says Peter. And when that day of judgment comes, the covenant of Noah will do us no good. Only those better promises that are available to us through the new covenant of Jesus can secure our lives into that new age. You don't need to fear God. None of us need to fear God in a terror-stricken way at all. The promises are there. We don't need to be afraid of the future. The future is in his hands. What we do have to make sure is that we are in the covenant, that the rainbow covers us. There is water here. Is it for you?